This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. We're on Twitter at KUOW. There's a discussion going on our Facebook page about mass shootings and gun restrictions. I asked you yesterday for your reaction to the Las Vegas shooting, and this phone call speaks for a lot of our listeners.
Hey, Bill. This is Lisa. I'm in Bothell, Washington. And what I think about whenever I hear these stories about mass shootings or shootings is, why in the blank don't we have more gun restriction in this country? It just has to be harder for people to access guns. Better yet, we need to do what Australia has done. It sickens me that the gun lobby is so powerful that there's no amount of loss of life that can help our representatives to vote with good conscience instead of thinking about being reelected. And that's what I think about. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. It's not that voters don't want more gun restrictions. Large majorities of Americans say they support universal background checks, required permits, and banning certain guns. But even in a blue state like ours, it is hard to pass gun restrictions. So when that listener asks,
why in the blank don't we have more gun restriction in this country?
Well, we want to get you an answer from someone who has tried and in some cases failed to get restrictions passed here. Ralph Fasciatelli, board president of Washington Cease Fire, a Seattle nonprofit dedicated to reducing gun violence. Welcome, Ralph.
Thanks, Bill.
First of all, is the week of a mass shooting a good time to call for gun restrictions or a bad time because both sides already predictably fiercely have their backs up?
I think it's the only time. And the reason why those, you know, on the gun rights side, this is a visceral issue to them that is their number one issue. For most of us on the gun safety side, and I'd like to think there's a middle ground there too, but, you know, there's a number of issues that take up our lives. And unfortunately, when you have a mass shooting like this, you know, there's a sensitivity that lasts for about 10 or 14 days, and then we get on with the rest of our lives. So if we don't have that conversation, you know, soon after, we won't have a conversation.
But doesn't history show us that we have this conversation soon after, over and over, and here we're still talking about this?
We are still talking about it, but the stakes are too high. You know, we can't turn the other cheek. I mean, we keep raising the number of what the greatest mass shooting is. I mean, this is almost 600 people were wiped out in you know, a matter of minutes, and it's changing our culture. People can't go to church, they can't go to the theater, they can't go to a concert. You know, gun violence is just destroying our country, and we've got to find that middle ground solution that respects the Second Amendment. I heard your caller say, can't we be like Australia? No, we can't. We are not going to do away with guns in this society. Let's accept the Second Amendment. Let's respect the right to have a gun. But let's also, like Justice Scalia said, let's find those middle ground solutions that are still respectful to the Heller Agreement of 2008 that can save lives. And, you know, part of the problem that we face is everybody wants a panacea to the gun violence issue. There is no panacea. There is no one gun law that's just going to make gun deaths go away. We have to take a very incremental approach. Our organization, Washington Ceasefire, has taken the national lead in technology as a possible approach, smart guns that can only be fired by the authorized user that we think could reduce gun violence by 25%.
Well, in the case of Las Vegas, this shooter was buying at least some of his guns legal. They were his guns. So
sure.
It's smart guns, that's about only letting the owner fire it. In this case, the owner was fired.
That would not have stopped that. But that's the problem with mass shootings. They only represent about 1% of all deaths. And so people are looking for the solution to a high-profile instance that really is only impacting about 1%.
But, well, there's an example of why I ask, is this the most productive time to talk about the gun restrictions you want when we are talking about this specific thing at the hotel 32nd sure. floor of Mandalay Bay?
Sure. When you realize we've had 2 million deaths since January 2017, if we impact, you know, 1%, then we're talking about a really big number here. And there are steps. Even though we bought them legally, that suggests we should change the laws to make it illegal to buy a semi-automatic weapon that can fire 100 bullets a minute. These are military-style assault weapons that are marketed as such. They're not hunting tools. Nobody needs 100 bullets a minute, you know, to shoot a deer. And nobody needs 100 bullet capacity, you know, to guard their house. We strongly have been pushing, and with the help of the Attorney General Bob Ferguson, a ban of semi-automatic weapons and a ban on ammunition magazine capacity of no more than 10 bullets that we think incrementally can reduce the number of shootings like this.
Okay, so on Facebook, when Jessica asks, does Washington State have laws that would have prevented someone like the Vegas shooter from buying weapons? That answer is no. We don't know all about all his weapons yet.
The answer is no. I'm not proud of our state. I think we need to see more leadership from the governor. I think the governor has led from behind on the gun issue. I could say with Washington ceasefire with Attorney General Bob Ferguson pushed for a ban on assault weapons. We didn't see the governor in that battle, and it didn't even get out of committee. Now, the Democrats.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's not a top of mind issue. I mean, look at here in the. It is not. Look at the mayoral battle here in Seattle. Everybody's talking about homelessness and bikes. I haven't seen one question about gun violence. And okay, because of the law of preemption, Seattle can't create its own laws, but it does have a bully pulpit, you know, in Olympia. It can do public health campaigns to tell people about the importance of safe storage. It can take a lead about technology and what technology can reduce the gun violence. But here in the bluest of states, the most intelligent of states, of cities, the city that's been hit by the, you know, the Capitol Hill massacre, about the Jewish Federation shooting, about Seattle U, so many shootings in this city. In the mayor's race here, you know, two liberal candidates, nobody's mentioned gun violence.
Well, at the state level, what about initiatives? That's where some of the gun restrictions have happened in Washington State, not through the legislature, but through the initiative process.
You need about 7 or 8 laws that incrementally, in the aggregate, can reduce gun violence by a half. We know, according to studies, you know, by Dr. David Hemenway, that those states that have the most comprehensive gun laws have about 1/6 of the level of violence of those states that have the loosest. Connecticut, Massachusetts, California, groups like that.
Those states have banned semi-automatic rifles.
Have banned it.
I'm asking why would that succeed in a statewide voter initiative in blue Washington? I know it's purple Washington State, but would that pass?
It could, but you know, the last time we had an initiative, on background checks, it cost $10 million to that. You know, we did a survey on assault weapons ban. We got 66% approval. It was actually 3-1. It wasn't 66-34. It was people in the middle. It was like 3-1, yes versus no, with people in the middle. Now, we got a representative government. Why can't our legislators, particularly when we got a Democratic governor, Democrats can control the House, and hopefully the Democrats can control in the Senate, you know, come this legislative session, why can't they pass something so basic?
Do you think that if the Democrats were to take majority in the state Senate, even by a slight bit, because right now it's just a slight Republican majority, do you think that would be a game changer for gun restrictions?
It should be, but I haven't seen a lot of leadership out of Frank Chop or Jamie Peterson or the Governor Jay Inslee. I'm hoping Cyrus Habib is somebody sensitive to this issue, along with Bob Ferguson, who's been great. You know, we need to see a change in priority. The gun violence is one of the most pressing priorities for the Democratic Party in the state.
Then what do you need to do differently? What do gun control groups need to do differently from what they're doing now?
I think they need to keep on the pressure. And unfortunately, you know, when something like Las Vegas happens, it does create an urgency. What we need to do is sustain that urgency and get in the middle of the debate and say, look, homelessness is important, okay? But it shouldn't dominate the agenda. We need to talk more about gun violence. Change does work. We've seen it from the states that have been effective in passing laws. And we're a blue state. We're a state that's likely to have complete legislative control by the Democratic Party and the governor. There's no reason Washington State shouldn't pass more reasonable gun safety legislation that is not in violation of the Second Amendment. We just need stronger leadership from the Democratic Party.
Well, for example, could it be that gun control advocates are talking past some of the people of Washington State? some gun rights advocates see mass shootings as a reason to weaponize themselves. Most voters may say they support gun regulations, but many gun rights voters are more passionate about it because, for one thing, they don't want to be told how they're allowed to defend themselves in their own home. Are you getting at the differences in outlook in Washington state?
Well, first of all,
not just advocating your cause over and over.
As I mentioned, we respect the Second Amendment. You're going to have, frankly, wing nuts in both the left and the right, okay? And they're not going to listen. They're going to be hardened. I want to reach out to the other side, the people in the middle, and say, look, this is an American issue. This is a state issue, gun violence. Now, where can we agree on that? And we're finding from our polls that we've actually had a plurality of gun owners agree on universal background checks. So, most gun owners are very responsible. We don't argue about their right to have a gun in the home. We do argue, the need for these military assault weapons that don't belong in consumer hands.
Who are wing nuts on the left when it comes to gun rights?
Well, there are people that don't want smart guns out there because they don't want a safer gun to be a solution to the reducing gun violence out there. They're afraid that smart guns are going to mean more home gun ownership. There are people who that when there was a fireproof cigarette, for instance, didn't want that to happen, even though that would save lives, from fires, because they thought that would increase the cigarette population. So there are idealists and utopians out there on both sides that actually affect common sense centrist progress.
That's interesting. So you're telling some utopians who are listening to you right now, hey, you're not helping.
Well,
is the
people
right?
That want a ban of the Second Amendment, that's not adding to the conversation. Let's find reasonable common ground, acknowledge the problem. There's 117,000 people shot annually. A child in this country is 14 times more likely to die than other countries on there. This is America's problem. Gun owners are losing their kids too, Let's respect the Second Amendment. Let's respect people's right to own a gun. And let's work together and pass some reasonable legislation that incrementally is going to reduce the carnage.
You're looking for a ban on semi-automatic mm-hmm. rifles in Washington mm-hmm. state, right? A limit on magazines?
I actually take the latter first. I think if we can have a limit on ammunition capacity to 10, that's even more important because it limits the firepower of semi-automatic weapons and also limits the firepower of handguns as well on that. So if I had to pick one of them, that would be it.
Okay, and smart gun technology as well. So just a couple more questions. Why would if the gun lobby is so strong in Washington state, why would a candidate advocate more gun control if they know they'll just be defeated or kept out of office?
Well, they won't be defeated. The vast majority of people here want common sense gun control. They don't want, like I say, the far left ban the Second Amendment and stuff like that. We need to tune that out. That is not helpful. Maybe well intended, but it's not helpful. We're not.
You think that's a myth that the gun lobby drums you out, or you get primaried on your right, et cetera? That you think it's not as fatal to a campaign as we talk about it being?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
You look at all the polling, and people are in favor of common sense gun control. Like I said, we did an assault weapons ban poll. 3-1 favorability in this state last year.
But that what voters tell pollsters is different from which voters turn out to vote and organize and have the passion behind it.
That is to some degree. But when you have a 3-1 margin, there's a lot of margin for error there as well. Yeah. And I think we need to talk respectfully to the gun-owning community. We're not out to take their guns away. But we need to find common ground and because we got a real problem on our hand here that isn't going to go away. It's only going to get worse.
Okay, maybe a final question. Shelley asks on KUOW's Facebook page, what is the best use of energy for Washingtonians? Who to call, et cetera, she asks.
Well, I think it's their legislators. I think whoever they're it has to be on the state level because the state law of preemption prevents cities and municipalities from creating their own gun laws. So everything needs to be done on the state level here. So I think what they need to do is to email their legislators or call their legislators. And I think, first and foremost, I think the top priority now is to ban semi-automatic weapons and to put a 10-bullet limit on ammunition clips. So that's what they could do.
Okay. Ralph Fascitelli, are you going to do anything different because of this shooting at a country music festival in Las Vegas?
Well, we are going to amplify our message. I mean, we've got an opinion piece going out in the Seattle Times tomorrow about the three things that can be done to reduce gun violence. We're holding a rally December 14th at Green Lake to mark the fifth-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook massacre. So what we want to hope to do is to keep the issue alive longer and make it a priority going into the coming legislative session.
Ralph Fascitelli, board president of Washington Ceasefire, a Seattle nonprofit dedicated to reducing gun violence. Thanks to the listeners who've weighed in, gave us that phone call and those comments on Facebook. And Ralph, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, very much.
This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Back in a moment. A moment ago, I was talking with Ralph Fascitelli from Washington Ceasefire. He mentioned, among other things, our mayor's race here in Seattle. Actually, the candidates both did weigh in yesterday on that Las Vegas shooting. In part, Carrie Moon said, "We must strengthen our local, state, and national protections against gun violence, such as Attorney General Ferguson's proposal to ban assault-style guns in high-capacity magazines." She goes on to say, "We must stand strong together and tell the NRA and other violence apologists that enough is enough. We cannot let this happen in Seattle or anywhere else again." And Jenny Durkin says, in part, "We must do more. We should not pretend this is not preventable. We should not accept this as an unavoidable consequence of constitutional freedom. We should not allow this to become normal. If Washington, D.C. cannot act, Washington State and Seattle should. We can and should work together to enact rigorous laws to prevent these attacks." Those are your two candidates for the mayorship of Seattle. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. It is a proud, progressive city. Its residents might even be a little self-congratulatory about that progressivism, but then something happens that reminds people it's also a mostly white city where it's hard to see white privilege.
I think it's a little bit like, you know, if you've grown up and you inherit money from your parents and then you find out that your money came from a crime. It's a little bit of that feeling of saying, well, I didn't commit this crime. Why should I have to give up the money?
That's Celeste Ng, and she's not exactly talking about Seattle. She's talking about Shaker Heights, Ohio, where she grew up and where she set her new novel called Little Fires Everywhere. Ng says she sees some similarities between her hometown and Seattle.
I have a cousin who lives here, and I also have a good friend who lived here for several years, and so I've gotten to come and visit them. And by coincidence, both of them actually had also lived in Shaker Heights. And so I can see some similarities between Shaker Heights and sort of the desire to be progressive and the desire to do right and the desire to sort of live with your eyes on the world that I think is also here in Seattle.
How have you noticed that?
Well, I remember that when we came being told about the composting, which is something that we only have just gotten in Cambridge, where I live now, and that you pay, I don't know if this is still true at the time, I guess you paid for the size of garbage can that you had, and so compost was free. And so that kind of, I think, really, really wonderful and commendable desire to kind of pay attention to the world around you and to be thinking about sort of how your actions go outwards into the world, I think is a wonderful thing. And I remember in Shaker Heights in about 1991 getting recycling bins, and that was sort of cutting edge at the time that we were recycling both glass and metal, you know.
Uh-huh. And what do you notice? How do you think about that idealization? Some of us idealize ourselves here in Seattle.
I think that it's a really commendable impulse. I think that communities that sort of structure themselves around ideals do so for the best of reasons, that they really believe that your ideals are not just sort of a nice idea that you have, but actually a principle by which you can live your life and a principle by which you can structure your life. And that's really sort of what Shaker Heights does, I think, that it really believes in trying to promote racial integration and racial equality. It really believes in trying to be progressive and in trying to sort of be forward thinking and equitable and inclusive. The problem is that ideals are very neat and real life and humans are very messy. And I think that's where you run into trouble when the messiness of human life sort of runs into the high ideals that you're trying to live by. Which one of those things is going to give way?
In your novel, you have characters who say that they don't see race. What does that mean to you?
Well, I remember in the 90s when I was growing up in Shaker Heights, and I think this was true in a lot of places, that the way that you expressed your racial awareness was to say, I don't see race, to just sort of deny that it existed and therefore deny that it could make a difference. I think now we see that in a little bit more complicated of a lens, that we understand that to deny race or to pretend that it doesn't exist is actually to deny a person's lived experience, to deny the context in which they grew up or in which their family grew up or in which the society around them frames them. And to me, to say, I don't see race, I try to interpret it as people meaning race doesn't matter to me. But it's a very fine line to walk between saying it doesn't matter to me and saying I understand it doesn't make you lesser to me, which is, I think, what they mean to say. But often that's not exactly what they are saying. So if you talk to somebody who's Black or who's Latino or who's Asian or really any person of color, they probably see race and they probably have to see race. There's no option for them not to, because other people make sure that they know they're a person of color. I think this happens a lot also in literature and in film, where we see whiteness centered as the default. Recently, there was a discussion with Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, who said, well, he hasn't written a novel about race because as a white man, he didn't feel that he could talk about those issues. I think it's very perceptive of him to realize that he shouldn't write about people of color. But the fact is that even as a white man, he's writing about race. He is writing about white people and the experience of whiteness.
So what do you think when a white person believes that they don't see race, what's happening inside them? What are they trying to do?
I think it comes from a really good place. I think it comes from trying to look at the most important things about a person, which are personality, you know, seeing them as a fellow human being, seeing the things that you share in common. The problem, if someone says to me, I don't see race when I look at you, I don't see you as an Asian woman, I just see you as a person, kind of means to me that they're then not aware or they're denying a lot of things that I have to deal with in my everyday life. My husband is a tall white guy. And we realize, you know, we've come to realize over the years that because of the way that we've grown up, we see the world really differently. This is the source of a lot of marital bickering because we tend to assume that the world works in different ways. So if we're standing in the middle of the sidewalk and someone comes along, my impulse is to move way out of the way. And his impulse is, oh, if I'm in the way, they'll squeeze by or they'll just ask me and I'm happy to move over. There's a certain assumption, I think, that the people are going to follow the rules, that the system is going to work for him, and that if he's noticed, he'll be given the benefit of the doubt. And I have been yelled at by people who thought that I was in the way, regardless of whether I was or not, basically because they saw my Asian face and thought I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, down to that kind of level where I realize all my life I've been sort of thinking about everything in that way of saying, you know, I'm going to assume that the system is not going to work as planned, that I'm not going to get the benefit of the doubt. So to say to somebody, a person of color or, you know, really any marginalized group, that I don't see the thing that makes you different is to sort of ignore something that has probably shaped their entire reality. And it seems to me that it's going to be hard to actually reach a real understanding with somebody if you leave out that huge part of their lives.
I can tell you when I've had those, I'm a white man, when I've had those impulses to, for example, delay teaching my kids about racism, or, you know, it comes up here and there. I notice my own utopianism. And I think the well-meaning idea is that we're trying to get to this better place. At what cost do you think we think that way in Seattle and beyond?
Well, I don't think that those utopian ideals or those utopian goals are a bad thing at all. I think we can hold on to that. But I think that it has to coexist with, you know, a kind of clear-eyed look at where we are, and that we have to recognize that good intentions are not enough. There's a scene in the book, this doesn't give too much away, there's a scene in the book, there's a custody battle over an Asian baby, and the prospective white adoptive mother is sort of being questioned by an Asian male lawyer who's sort of asking her about how she's going to keep this baby connected to her birth culture. And it gets very uncomfortable for everybody, because what kind of emerges and what's clear to everyone, including the white would-be adoptive mother, is that she doesn't really know anything about Asian culture, and she doesn't know how she's going to keep that in this child's life if she gets to be its mother. And what happens in that situation is the lawyer comes out looking like the bad guy. The lawyer comes out being painted as the bad guy, where he was too aggressive. He was pushing her too hard. He made her cry. And I think that's there's a parallel there between what happens in the novel and what happens in the world when people have good intentions and they try and talk about these things and are called out on blind spots or places where they make mistakes, that often that discomfort is too much to sit with, and they have to sort of turn it outwards and say, well, I'm not going to take issue with what you said. You might have a point, but you made me uncomfortable in doing it this way. You know, the way that you're protesting is not the right way to go about this. And I think we see that happening now, like with the protests that are happening at sports events around the national anthem. People are uncomfortable with that. And the reaction has been to turn on the players who are making mostly white populations uncomfortable. I have a friend who always says, I can tell when I'm going to learn something because I become very uncomfortable.
That's beautiful.
And she's right. And I think a lot of that is, you know, part of that learning process is sitting with that discomfort and going, okay, I'm uncomfortable, rather than lashing out at the person who's making me uncomfortable and telling them that it's their fault for making me uncomfortable. Let me sit with that discomfort for a little bit and think about, why is it that I'm uncomfortable? I hope that's something that we're starting to be able to do more in our conversations about race.
You know, that discomfort you're talking about does get at conversations I have often with listeners, often it's emails. There's a frustration with being told, quote unquote, over and over that we're the bad guys. So you're saying if I'm uncomfortable, then maybe some learning, some growth is happening. I also want to give some credit. I swear I'm not pandering here, but some credit to KOW listeners and the people of the Puget Sound area. I don't have benefit of perspective yet, but I really feel like I'm seeing people of many races doing this work. Have you found that in Shaker Heights or Cambridge or in your own life? In America?
I think so. Maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I feel like I'm really proud of a lot of things that Cambridge does. We certainly are not getting it all right, but I feel like the willingness to talk about these things and the willingness to try and make mistakes and then own the mistakes and then keep on trying and not sort of be scared away from trying to talk about race or trying to make change at all, I feel like is a huge, huge step. I feel like we as a nation hopefully are moving towards that, largely because the issues that we're facing are becoming so pressing that we don't have much of a choice. I think we have to talk about things like police violence against Black people. And we have to talk about, racism in everything from sports to immigration to how news gets reported. I'm thinking about the news about the shooting in Las Vegas, where even the way that news outlets talk about the shooter, they say it's not terrorism because he was just a lone wolf, and often there's a racial coding in there where we are very reluctant to call people who are white terrorists. And I think the fact that people are having these conversations at all is a really good start. So like you say, I see people in a lot of different places starting to do that work of expanding our conversation.
You yourself, Celeste, are writing in this book, it's the adoption of a Chinese baby. But you've written about race before. What kind are you making anybody uncomfortable? Are you getting pushback yourself?
I'm sure I am. I know that I think all the writers that I know who are talking about race get a fair amount of resistance because it makes people uncomfortable. And reasonably enough, our impulse is when we're uncomfortable is just like, let's just move away from that. A friend of mine, Nicole Chung, who is a wonderful writer, she's a transracial adoptee herself, wrote an essay about being a transracial adoptee in a family that is supporting Trump. And she's having a very hard time with it. And her essay, I thought, was really perceptive and really thoughtful and really searching and I think probably difficult for her to write. And when it came out earlier this week, she had a lot of people saying, well, I think that, you know, you really just, you shouldn't talk about it, or you're being too political. You should stay out of politics and you should just stay with literature, as if those two things can be extricated from each other. Or they'll say, well, I think your point is reasonable, but there's always all these sorts of ways that people, I think, would feel threatened by people bringing up these discussions. And the thing is that they are discussions that are uncomfortable, but I think that that not having them is often more uncomfortable. So I've had a little bit of pushback every now and then from readers who say, you know, I don't think what you said could be true. And I say, well, that's okay. You know, thank you for reading the book. And I think that a lot of writers who are starting to have these conversations have also received pushback like that.
You wrote this book before Donald Trump was president. How has the Trump presidency changed any of this for you?
Yeah, I wrote the book largely between 2014 and 2016, so well before Donald Trump became president. And I actually had started working on the plot and working on the characters in 2009, which is a really different political era than we are now. And frankly, when I sold the book to my publisher in September of 2016, I thought we were going to be in a somewhat different place than we are now. And it's been interesting to go out on book tour and talk to readers and hear reviews and hear interpretations of the book in the era of Trump, because the words on the page are the same, of course, but we read them in a really different light now.
How are people interpreting it in a Trumpy way?
Well, it's less that it's a Trumpy way. I think it is more sort of, it's being seen as a commentary on, I think, idealism versus action and the way that we maybe have our principles up until the point where they make us uncomfortable. I think that the questions of race that are brought up in the book resonate really strongly right now. The questions of race, the questions of class between the Richardson family and the Warrens, between the McCulloughs, this white couple that wants to adopt this Asian baby, and the birth mother, all of those sorts of threads of race and class and privilege are ringing loud and clear for us now. But the fact is that they've always been present all the time. I mean, they were present when I was thinking about them in 2009, and they were not new then. It's only more, I think, that they've sort of risen up to the top of our national consciousness that we are starting to see them in the books that we're reading now. I think it's really hard to read anything in the age of Trump and not see it as some sort of existential question about who we really are as a nation.
That's writer Celeste Ng. And yes, she wrote that bestseller, Everything I Never Told You, and her new novel is called Little Fires Everywhere. So there was Celeste Ng just a moment ago. We talked about keeping a Chinese-American baby connected to her birth culture. That's a familiar idea to the host of KUOW's new podcast, Second Wave. Tan Tan has a story now of local Vietnamese Americans connecting to their heritage with the help of beauty pageants.
I grew up watching the Miss America pageant with my family on TV every year. That drum roll, the narrowing down of contestants from 50 to 10 to 5. Miss America represented the big time, prime time. So in our Vietnamese-American refugee community, we developed our own version of these beauty pageants. Instead of evening gowns, the women, though, they would model the Vietnamese áo dài, a long tunic dress that has deep slits on either side, with really flowy pants underneath. And we often say in our culture that these dresses, they cover everything, and yet they hide nothing, because they are so form-fitting. Now, wherever there's a Vietnamese community, there's a pageant. Miss Vietnam, Mrs. Vietnam, Miss Áo Dài, and so on. These shows have become part of the Vietnamese-American experience. And I distinctly remember my first experience with these pageants. I'm about 7 years old, and I'm wearing a red silk Áo Dài with gold embroidery that I wore the year before as a flower girl at a Vietnamese wedding. And I think I'd grown a bit. The dress was not comfortable. I remember that. And I'm holding my mom's hand at the Tet Lunar New Year party in Olympia, Washington. And then suddenly someone comes up to us and tells us that I've won something. I remember my mom being like, "What?" And before I know it, someone is holding up my wrist and parading me on stage before a couple hundred Vietnamese attendees.
Where is it? Oh, here we are. So here's a picture of me standing in our living room that day. This is like post-pageant glow.
I got a bouquet of flowers, and I felt like a swan. But I can't remember what title I actually won. I don't remember if I was the winner or if I was the runner-up. So I call my mom to ask her what she remembers. That's me in Vietnamese, basically asking my mom if she remembers that day. She does not. She insists she never entered me in a pageant. And I ask her, "But, you know, what about the flowers?" "I don't remember," she says. "Stop asking me."
Okay, bye. My mom. Oh my God, she doesn't remember. Hey, Wynn.
Hi, Tom.
I try my sister.
Do you remember me winning some flowers and some kind of a pageant when I was a little girl?
No.
So one of the most exhilarating moments of my childhood, when I felt this acknowledgement, like maybe I was special and I was pretty.
There's photos of it.
It's a moment that no one else remembers. Now that I'm not seven, I see through the pageant a little more. I see the way that they objectify women and create this false image of a perfect Vietnamese-American woman. So when my niece, she's very sweet, she's a student at the University of Washington, when she asked me to judge their version of a pageant called Miss Hoa Khoi Liang Trung, which roughly translates to flower among the schools, I had to pause and think about it. And despite my better judgment, I said yes.
Find out what happened at that beauty pageant when you listen to the entire episode of KUOW's new podcast, Second Wave, hosted by Tan Tan. That was just an excerpt. You can subscribe to Second Wave wherever you get your podcasts or go to KUOW.org/podcast. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Every year at Evergreen State College in Olympia, students, faculty, and staff of color leave the campus for a day of absence. They spend the day away working on ideas for making the campus a more equitable place. Last year, the organizers suggested that white students and faculty stay off campus for a change. An Evergreen biology professor who's white objected to that. He called it a show of force and an act of oppression. And many students objected back at him in protest.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho! These racist teachers have got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! These racist teachers have got to go!
Students used furniture to barricade the school's library door. And when the story went national, Evergreen got threats and they shut down the campus for 3 days. Now the school has sanctioned 80 students for breaking Evergreen's code of conduct. Reporter Chris Quintana has been covering the campus culture wars for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
80 students at Evergreen got formal warnings or probation or community service or even suspension. How unusual is that for a school to discipline students over protests?
You know, we don't see a whole lot of that. And I think part of the reason is you don't want to appear as though you're clamping down on a student's right to free speech, you know, whether a private or a public university that is very important to the academic mission. And so for this to actually have happened is a bit unusual.
Those protests at Evergreen were national news. There was a New York Times headline that said the campus was under siege. Why did a college of 4,000 students in Olympia, Washington, get so much national attention?
Well, you know, there are a lot of factors here. I mean, part of it is, you know, the professor at the center of this, Brett, and his wife, Heather, you know, actively tried to get the word out. You know, there was a column in the Wall Street Journal. They appeared on Fox News. So, I mean, that certainly is a part of it. But I think
there was a cell phone video as well.
Right, right. I think there's also something about the narrative at Evergreen that plays into what a lot of people suspect or think about college campuses, that students are entitled and want a safe space and want things to be catered to them in a very specific way. And Evergreen could be an example of that.
Yeah, and Evergreen was not the only school with protests last year. Yeah,
right.
maybe, as you say, maybe the campus is kind of an ideal place for some people to have this debate. What are other campuses and states, what are they doing about their protests?
You know, I think they try to handle them as best they can, although it's really hard to tell with these sort of things. I mean, if you look at UC Berkeley, right, what started as a peaceful protest of Milo Yiannopoulos in February kind of devolved into violence rather unexpectedly. And you know, the university has since really upped its police presence at events, you know, that were to feature Ann Coulter or Milo Yiannopoulos recently again. So, I mean, that's one way of addressing it, but you know, that's also a concern of cost. It's expensive to have officers. It's also a question of, do you militarize the campus? It's not, there aren't easy answers here.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter. These right-wing provocateurs, they seem to be targeting liberal arts colleges because they're supposed to be a marketplace of ideas, but they're also dominated by passionate young liberals. You said, you used the word entitled, right? This is strategic provoking, isn't it?
I think, and you know, the Milo Yiannopoulos has made it clear. He has said that you know, he's interested in speaking at universities to address the, you know, the left, to break that narrative. He talked about in heading to UC Berkeley about shattering echo chambers and ending political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, these things have started at the university. So in that way, you could say that they are focused, yes.
And at Evergreen, it wasn't just students and, you know, a right-wing speaker. There were we had the dynamics with the biology professor and the day of absence, but also outside groups coming in and changing the dynamics. Is that a trend,
yeah,
that outside groups participate?
Yeah, that's an increasing trend, and it's not only outside groups actually coming to campus. There's a huge amount of interest in Evergreen State online. I have a search term that I regularly check on Evergreen State, and you just have a lot of people who are really interested in the college and talking about it online. And you know, even the school's Reddit page was briefly overrun with people from the internet who were posting about how this school was a loss or what was going on here. You know, it's the interest. When people start getting interested from the outside, it kind of changes the tone a little bit. That's when you get things like threats that close down the campus.
And what's new this year? Here it's a new school year. What are you seeing so far?
You know, that's still to be decided in a lot of ways. But you know, so far we've obviously had Milo Yiannopoulos. He's going to be going around. We continue to see professors kind of at the center of these controversies. You know, whether it's you know, a recent example of a professor who tweeted about cops dying at John Jay College, and that attracted a lot of attention in New York. So I think that's kind of what we're going to be seeing more of this year as well. These controversies start a lot of the time online, and that would be a good place to watch for them.
Finally, Chris, the bigger picture, how long do you think these campus protests will go on at this level in this way? How do you see this playing out?
You know, that's a good question. I was trying to, that's something I talk with my colleagues a lot about, is kind of like, when does this fever die down? And, you know, it's really hard to say. I would say at least through the current fall semester, potentially into the spring semester. It also depends on kind of, I think, you know, given the current political atmosphere, I think that's that plays into it as well, and if that doesn't go away for another 4 or 8 years, I mean, we might be seeing a lot of this.
Chris Quintana has been covering the campus culture wars, free speech on college campuses for the Chronicle of Higher Education. So he's looking from a national level at schools like Evergreen and University of Washington, Berkeley, and more. Chris, good to talk with you. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. You have a good day now.
It's KUOW's The Record. This spring, an underground train tunnel full of radioactive waste was discovered partly collapsed at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in southeast Washington. Now, federal contractors are prepping the site to fill the unstable tunnel with grout. Correspondent Anna King says that raises some questions.
Tunnel 1 at Hanford is full of train cars contaminated with radioactive waste. Experts at the site say the best solution is to fill it up with grout, or a sort of thin concrete. Alex Smith is with Washington State's Department of Ecology. She's the head watchdog for Washington on Hanford.
It actually makes it easier to remove the waste at the end of the day, because right now it's really difficult to get highly radioactive, large pieces of equipment out of the tunnel. But if it's encapsulated in grout, that helps protect the workers who might be doing the removal. And when it's encapsulated in that grout, it's more easily cut up by a high-powered wire cutter into small pieces, and then you can package those pieces up for shipment offsite.
But some people have questioned that premise. If you fill up the tunnel with grout, can you ever clean it up? I asked the U.S. Department of Energy, which runs Hanford, for more information. A federal spokesman said he didn't have those answers and couldn't put me in touch with any government expert who did. So, to get some idea of what it would take to cut up and haul away this tunnel slab by slab, I consulted top Northwest demo experts. Vern Balkowicz Jr. has cut apart complicated stuff, like massive river dams. On the Hanford Tunnel.
It doesn't make sense what they're trying to do.
Here in his shop, Balkowicz shows me a diamond-cutting wire. This is what the feds say they would use to cut up the tunnel. It looks sort of like a coiled climbing rope. It cuts like a chainsaw blade attached to a big electric motor.
So as this is spinning, it's throwing debris wherever it's at. It's throwing debris all around it, like a sprinkler.
You said like a sprinkler? Is like chips are flying everywhere?
No, not chips. It's grinding. It grinds the concrete. That's how it cuts. So then it throws it all over the place.
And it's really contaminated stuff. There's even plutonium. So Balkowicz says Hanford would have to have some sort of complicated shielding to keep all that dust and slurry away from workers. Maybe even use robots. Once the tunnel is cut up, then it would have to be craned out piece by piece and hauled away with large trucks. Damian Hinkle spends his time tapping away on a well-patinaed 10-key calculator. He's the lead estimator with Dixon Company in Tacoma. That's a large-scale demolition outfit. Hinkle says running the numbers on demo is half study, half gut feeling. His gut on Hanford's grout plan for Tunnel 1?
It's a lot.
He says Tunnel 1 will have something like 11,000 tons of grout, tunnel debris, and the structure itself. To tear all that up would be like when his company demolished the old King 5 studio on Dexter in Seattle.
It was a four-story building made out of reinforced concrete. Took up a city block.
A whole city block?
Yeah.
So we're talking a whole city block, four stories high of concrete, would be what the tunnel is underground.
Correct.
Hinkle says trucking away that contaminated material will likely be one of the largest costs of the project. Washington's watchdog, Alex Smith, has looked at these questions and doesn't think cleanup will be simple, but says something has to be done with the tunnel now. It could collapse further.
This was the best of the solutions that we saw for Tunnel 1.
Even so, the plan for cleanup of the tunnel won't even begin until the year 2020. I'm Anna King in Richland.
Coming up tomorrow on KUOW's The Record, you may know Zoe Quinn from Gamergate, the semi-organized harassment campaign that spread through social media. She's written a book called Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and how we can win the fight against online hate. We're going to talk to game designer and user advocate Zoe Quinn tomorrow on The Record. I hope you can join us.